We're here at Menards Bank Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will talk with an expert from the CDC about heart valve disease, and he'll chat with the president of the American Medical Association about doctor pay cuts and shortages in Columbus. Plus, Angela Ann is filling in for Doug Petcash of Face the State, and we'll have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
There are over 3,000 primary care doctors here in Columbus. The doctors who accept Medicare could face another pay cut in 2025. Medicare physician payment has been cut 29% since 2001, with an additional 2.8% proposed as a cut next year. Dr. Bruce Scott is the president of the American Medical Association and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
You too. What do Medicare cuts mean for these physicians and their practices?
Well, patients are having increasing difficulty getting in to see their doctor, and for practices like mine, we're struggling to survive. And a big part of the reason is exactly what you mentioned. Medicare has cut what they pay physicians 29% since 2001. Can you even imagine getting paid 30% less today for the same work that you did back in 2001? We all know that everything costs more now than it did 20-plus years ago. And to make matters worse, now the federal government is planning another cut starting January 1st unless Congress acts to stop it. It's unsustainable for our practices, and in the end, it's the patients that are harmed.
How are the patients actually harmed? Can't they just find other doctors?
Well, the problem is that a recent survey showed that one in five physicians are looking to leave their practice in the next 2 years, and we already face a physician shortage. There are predictions of as much as an 80,000 physician shortage in the coming years, and it takes 8 to 10 years to train a new physician. But for many physicians, it truly may only be one more year of these cuts for them to quit. So that's why we need to fix Medicare, and we need to fix it now.
How does this impact senior citizens? Are they the only ones that are impacted because they're more likely to be on Medicare or Medicaid, or does it have an effect on others as well?
Well, these cuts directly threaten care provided to all patients, not solely Medicare patients. You see, most insurance companies, aware of the predictable downward spiral of Medicare payment every year, have tied their payment to Medicare rates. So as a result, physicians have had to make difficult choices, in some cases not updating their equipment or not retaining some of their staff, or in other cases, literally closing their practices. I'm aware of a practice in rural Ohio that after 27 years, the obstetrician gynecologist sadly has closed her practice because it could no longer financially survive. We can't afford to lose even one more doctor, but particularly not in the rural areas where patients are already really struggling to find physician care.
So what is the American Medical Association able to do about this issue?
Well, the AMA is calling on Congress to act before the end of the year to solve this payment crisis by simply providing a payment update that at least covers the cost of providing care for our patients. Now, this isn't some radical idea. It simply allows physicians to receive payment that increases with inflation. And we need patients, we need your listeners to contact their member of Congress to tell them that they want to make sure that Medicare is there for them and their parents in the future, and that they have the opportunity to continue to see their doctor, and that we need to fix this problem now.
What happens if Medicare and Medicaid go away? Then what?
I think we're facing a real crisis in America. These are some of the most vulnerable patients who need access to care by their physician. We all understand that access to a physician is the foundation of medical care. So we don't want to get there. We need to fix this problem now. And one of the ways your listeners can do that is by going to the website the AMA has created, fixmedicarenow.org. And there they can read more information about the problem and find information of how to contact their member of Congress and add their voice to this campaign of physicians and patients who are calling for us to fix this problem now.
Does a trend towards concierge physician service where they do not accept insurance but only cash payment, does that hinder or help the cause?
I think that's some of the direct result of the Medicare cuts, that particularly in paying to the expenses to take care of senior citizens, a lot of primary care physicians in particular have found it financially impossible to survive. And so they've turned to things like concierge care and such, which is okay for some patients, but for other patients, that's not really a financially viable alternative.
So it is the greater good that we are concerned with in this case.
Absolutely. You know, the Physicians of America, the American Medical Association, is concerned about patients and patients' access to care. We need to fix this problem, and we need to fix it now. We need Congress to act before the end of the year.
Dr. Bruce Scott is the president of the American Medical Association. We thank you for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
According to the most recent data from the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, Ohio ranks sixth in the nation for heart-related deaths in 2022, with more than 30,000 fatalities. Columbus ranked fifth in the nation for heart health in America, according to the ACLS. Today we're talking to Dr. Janet Wright. She's the director of the CDC's Division for Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention. We welcome you to Columbus Perspective, and we're going to talk about some serious issues today. So first of all, tell us about the CDC's efforts to raise awareness to heart valve disease specifically.
Yes, Jay, thank you so much for giving me a chance to chat with you and the folks in Columbus. You know, part of the name for CDC is prevention, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and we are hoping to help prevent harm from undetected and untreated heart valve disease. Turns out about 5 million people each year in the U.S. are diagnosed with it, but many people are missed. Those people might be more women than men, more Black or Asian American or Hispanic and Latino individuals than those who are white. And there are other risks for heart valve disease that may not be detected in a timely way. So we are out to help others help team up and remedy that.
For somebody that's listening right now that has a cursory understanding of the anatomy but may not fully understand, how do we describe heart valve disease?
Take a trip inside the heart. I will tell you, it is a thing of beauty. But each heart has four heart valves, and with each beat of the heart, the valves open and close. So they allow blood or steer blood through the heart in a single direction out to the body and out to the lungs. And really, they are beautiful. Heart valve disease can occur because of a number of different reasons. A person might be born with a valve that is slightly misshapen, and that with years of those valves opening and closing with each heartbeat, the valves are scarred and begin to either not open fully or not close. They become leaky. That same sort of process can occur because of a heart valve infection, maybe from gum disease or maybe from a streptococcus bug. And then there are some types of heart valve disease that happen in a family history or due to heart damage from a heart attack or heart failure. So multiple different causes.
So at the beginning of our conversation, you had mentioned that African Americans and Asian Americans are at higher risk, and we have a population that is dense in both of those categories. Why are they more at risk than others?
Yes, and actually what the numbers show is that they are less likely to be diagnosed in a timely way. It may not be that they're at higher risk, but they are less likely to have that heart valve disease detected. And that may be, we don't know all the reasons why. It may be that they are not have the access to regular medical care, or that when they're in the medical care setting, they don't raise the issue, or maybe their clinical team does not detect it. But we are trying to get the message out that individuals who are in those groups know how to ask the question. And this is the question I'd recommend. Hey, did you listen? When you listen to my heart, how do my valves sound? Do I have heart valve disease? Very important to raise that possibility so that we can make sure individuals of every race and ethnicity get the treatment that they need.
So we understand that the patient has to be an advocate for themselves and they have to ask the right questions. But part of that process, Dr. Wright, is really having an understanding for what to look for in your own body. So how do you know? What are the signs and symptoms?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question, because as beautiful as those heart valves are, I have to say they can be sneaky. Heart valve disease can creep up on a person. And, you know, we're remarkable organisms as humans. We are resilient and we tend to adjust our behavior to accommodate for any change in our physical status. So we often see individuals who, when they realize that, or when they're diagnosed with a heart valve disease, and then they start to think, yeah, you know, when I climb those stairs or I walk that hill, I really was more short of breath than usual. So the symptoms that can sneak up on a person are fatigue, more fatigue than you would expect, shortness of breath that occurs at a lower rate of exertion than normal, perhaps palpitations where you feel your heart race or skip. And then typical for a narrowed valve is a symptom of feeling very lightheaded or maybe even having a fainting spell. Those are warning signs of valve disease that's brewing and should trigger a trip to your clinical team and make sure that they listen to your heart.
Now, my doctor has always told me that if I ever have any questions or concerns, I should bring them to him. But so many people today are on their devices and they get on Google or WebMD. And I got to tell you, I had to stop doing that because I had diagnosed myself with every disease known to man, including rickets. That's not a good thing to do. Why is going to the doctor so important, and when should we go to the doctor?
Well, I'll have to tell you, I think there are resources out there, and I'll plug the ones that we've produced, both for clinical teams, clinical experts, as well as individuals in the public. And those are at cdc.gov/knowyourheart. Lots of information there that you can rely on. But the important thing about checking in with your clinical team is that they, first of all, will listen to your heart. They will actually take that stethoscope and take some time and hear whether there is a problem with the heart valves. And I just want to say, sometimes the barrier for us when we think about seeking medical care, there are lots of barriers, I'm afraid. But one of them is fear of what will they do. I want to say that in addition to listening to the heart, if a valve murmur or sound is heard that indicates possibility of heart valve disease, that doctor or nurse is likely to order an echocardiogram. That's an ultrasound test. It does not involve needles or pain or even exposure to radiation, and it gives the clinician and the technologist a good look at all four of the heart valves and can tell whether there's anything brewing there.
So later this year, I'd like to invite you back on the program to talk about stroke prevention, because obviously that's another conversation. But we want to thank Dr. Janet Wright from the CDC for being our guest today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Angela Ann. from the Sunday Morning Public Affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
But right now, several major bills are one step closer to becoming law here in Ohio. But time is running out for many other pieces of legislation. If they don't receive approval from both chambers by December 31st, those bills will have to be reintroduced next year. That includes one bill hoping to better protect unconscious patients from abusive doctors. House Bill 89 is now on its way to the Senate after unanimously passing the House. This proposed law would prohibit medical professionals or students from conducting intimate exams on an anesthetized or unconscious patient without consent unless it is medically necessary or other certain exceptions. Now, if that law is broken, the licensing board would be allowed to discipline the doctor. And despite heavy pushback from cities and business groups, the House passed a bill to require local governments to pay more into the public pension system that covers police and firefighters. Under House Bill 256, the employer contribution rate would go up an additional 4.5% to 24% for police. That matches the current rate for firefighters. This would also cost cities an additional $80 million a year. Those against it argue this will make it harder for cities to hire new officers and offer pay raises. House Bill 256 now heads to the Senate. And a bill aimed at making it easier to adopt a child is now on its way to the governor's desk after passing the House and the Senate unanimously. Among other changes, House Bill 5 would increase the amount a birth mother can receive for living expenses from $3,000 to $6,000. This would also allow time spent with relatives who plan to adopt a child to count towards that required six-month waiting period before adoption. And House Bill 5 will allow children to be adopted without their parents' consent if the parent had not provided, quote, meaningful and regular maintenance for 1 year before that adoption petition is filed. And as we approach 2025, we are less than a month away until the next General Assembly takes power. We'll see some new leaders stepping up in the Ohio House and the Senate. But one leader that is staying in her role is Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio. She's a Democrat from Northeast Ohio who was first elected to the Senate in 2018 and spent 8 years in the House before that. Senator, we want to thank you now for joining us. We do want to start also by being transparent here today by saying that we also invited the incoming Senate Majority Leader to join us, Republican Bob McCauley, but he was unavailable and declined our request. But now, Senator Antonio, let's start with you with this current General Assembly question. What can Ohioans really expect to come out of the State House before the year is over?
Well, first of all, thanks for the invitation. And I think what people can expect is some of the bills that are that you highlighted clearly that are moving at this point, again, may or may not make it across the finish line. We can start probably with the pension reform bill for police and fire. Bringing police up to where the firefighters' pensions are at. The current president of the Senate has indicated that he doubts there's time for us to delve into that. This General Assembly, my expectation is that bill, if it should not pass the Senate this time, it's going to come back in the next General Assembly. But I believe that it requires, and what's going to be required of legislators is to really delve into how this is funded, because part of we heard from our mayors, we've been hearing from our mayors in cities across the state saying they can't afford to pay for this. As many people may remember, the local government funds were cut during the previous administration and have stayed. And so we need to take a look at, are we starving our cities and keeping those local government funds from them? And this may be the conversation that triggers another look at increasing those funds so that our cities can maintain a level of law enforcement that's necessary to keep citizens safe.
Sure. And Senator, I know that there's been discussion of how do we fund it. Like you said, that's a critical piece. Mm-hmm. Some people have discussed maybe some of the sales tax revenue from marijuana sales now that are legal here in Ohio. Let me ask you this, sure. then. Is this going to be one of your top legislative priorities for the next General Assembly? Since it doesn't look like we'll pass the finish line on this one?
I think it's going to be as far as everyone should be able to have a pension to be able to retire on. I'm sure it's going to be on the list of priorities as we go into the next General Assembly, should it not cross the finish line, this GA.
You've been a consistent advocate for the Ohio Fairness Act. It would protect against employment discrimination, housing discrimination. Also, it would provide more protection for LGBTQ plus people in our state. How do you plan to build bipartisan support for this? Because I know this is something you've been pushing for years now.
Well, we continue to have the conversation. We continue to introduce the bill. The interesting thing is that the bill has so much support from business, large and small. It has support from the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, the Ohio Manufacturing Association. Those are not necessarily seen as progressive organizations in the political sense, but they are pragmatic and practical. And they understand that passing this bill really says that Ohio is open for business to all people. If we're going to increase our employees coming into the state, we need workers at every level of business, then this is an important bill for us to continue to talk to. It's also the right thing to do, but I have to say that the way we've been able to build support, we can all agree that in order for Ohio to be successful in the 21st century, we need workers that want to not only come to Ohio or stay in Ohio, especially younger people. We want them to raise their families here. And young people absolutely want an environment that welcomes all people.
Let me ask you this then. Where do you see any specific Republican-led initiatives that could have that bipartisan compromise between both parties?
I think some of the issues in terms of housing and property taxes, there have been studies, a committee focused specifically on it, very bipartisan task force. Many pieces of legislation have come out of that, especially addressing housing affordability. We know that that's an issue for people, again, across the state of Ohio. And whether you live in an urban environment, a rural area, or suburban somewhere in between, housing affordability is at critical levels. And so we have a number of pieces of legislation that absolutely, I believe, will make a difference and that there's bipartisan support for. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, Senator, I apologize. That's all the time we have. But certainly you have a very busy year ahead, sounds like it, and probably a busy end of the year here as well. But thank you again, Senator, for joining us today on Face the State.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again. We do also want to talk about something else that has been making news here, improving traffic safety all throughout Ohio, but specifically in the city of Springfield. This happened in the past week, a new initiative that will help the immigrant community in Clark County learn safe driving skills. The Maria Tiberi Foundation, along with the Virtual Driver Interactive, donated more than 10 new driving simulators to the Ohio Traffic Safety Office. These machines will be placed throughout the Springfield area. 10TV's Dom Tiberi and his family created this foundation after losing their daughter Maria in a distracted driving crash more than a decade ago. Since then, Dom has worked tirelessly to educate young people all across our state on the dangers of distracted driving.
When we lost Maria, we didn't know what we were going to do. But I knew we had to do something because, you know, we're losing too many people on our highways.
And with the influx of the immigrant population growing over the last decade, the city of Springfield continues to battle issues with that growth. Reporter Rochelle Aline walks us through why the state is stepping in now to help families.
According to the city of Springfield's website, they have anywhere from 12 to 15,000 immigrants overall in this area. Governor DeWine has said that recent influx of immigrants has put a strain on certain local resources like the school system and health care. He announced that he has invested more than $5 million to help improve things. But there are changes that come as we're also hearing reports that certain Haitian migrants are actually leaving the city following comments made by President-elect Donald Trump.
Pastor Reginald Salenzo says he came to Springfield from Haiti on heavenly assignment.
Because the Lord told him there's a community that needs him.
But as of late, members of his flock are now fleeing.
Quite a few of them have already left Springfield.
This all comes after recent comments by President-elect Donald Trump, who has spoken about mass deportation of migrants. Trump has also discussed a rollback of the federal government's temporary protected status program, which many migrants, including those in Springfield, use to remain in the U.S. legally. At a press conference in Springfield, we pressed Governor Mike DeWine about it.
I want to know what your response is to that vow and what message do you have to the Haitians who are worried about that status?
Well, my position has not changed. You know, I made it very clear a month ago I thought that would be a mistake.
DeWine went on to advise Haitian immigrants to consult with an attorney before making any decisions to leave. But despite this, the pastors we've spoken to say more than a dozen Haitians have already left for Canada or other U.S. states.
Is there really anything that any leader can say to reassure the Haitian community here in Springfield?
I think if they a press conference would be great by telling them America is a country of law. No one would just grab you on the street, deport you as long as you are legal.
We wanted to know what guidance the federal government is also providing on this issue, so I contacted the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Department for more information. I'll share the comments and the links that they provided on our website, 10TV.com. In Springfield, Rochelle Aline, 10TV News.
Rochelle, thank you. Well, after Democrats lost control of the White House and the U.S. Senate, Ohio's outgoing senator is now weighing in on what went wrong and what's next for the party.
One, are you out of touch on those issues? Two, should you guys have done a better job in pushing back?
In just 2 minutes, what Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown says his party needs to do moving forward if they want to get back on the winning path.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Now, just weeks remain until Ohio's longtime Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown vacates his office. He'll be replaced by incoming Republican Senator Bernie Moreno. The new Congress is set to be sworn in on January 3rd. And now Brown is sitting down with our CNN correspondent Manu Raju, reflecting on his loss and the limited time he has left in D.C.
How hard was November 5th for you?
Well, I lost, but we ran ahead of the national ticket.
Was there a sense that you thought you were going to pull this off, or was there a point where it seemed like this was going in the wrong direction?
No, I expected to win because I'm out a lot, and I talk to workers, I talk to people year-round. I come home, I listen to people, that's where my ideas come from. I expected to win because of that, because I saw the enthusiasm in the crowds. What I didn't see is the ad they did at the end where Trump said voting for Sherrod Brown is voting against me. And when the leader of your ticket runs 12 points behind almost, you can't overcome that, even though it was a close race in the end.
So Trump made the difference here.
A lot of things made the difference. I'd say it's the money in Trump. That kind of money just for month after month after month with nasty negative ads, all of which were found to be not true by neutral fact checkers. I guess that's how you win a race. You lie, you spend a lot of money, and then you, as my opponent, hope that your candidate, Trump in this case, would win by a lot.
So you don't think that Bernie Moreno ran a clean race?
You can be the judge of that. I think when you run ads and they're proven to be lies by fact checkers, you're a pretty smart analyst, Manu, and you can connect that dot and let you do it.
How much do you think that the Democratic brand hurts you in your state?
I don't particularly like the term brand, but the Democrats, since NAFTA, workers have drifted away from the Democratic Party. To me, politics is not really left or right. It's whose side you're on. Voters in Ohio know I'm on their side. I think we've drifted away as a party, and I want to, the Democrats, my mission is, as it was in the Senate, it will be the same out of the Senate, is to make the Democratic Party the party of workers.
Specifically how? Because how have you guys drifted away?
A Trump judge in East Texas knocked down. One judge cost four million workers that would have benefited. One judge, think about that. I'm pretty angry about it, as you can see. One judge denied 4 million workers in this country their overtime. We ought to be talking about that. My guess is you've never covered it. My guess is very little media have covered it. And I know that very few Democrats have talked about it. And Trump and his crowd, his corporate crowd that's always looking out for their rich friends, hope it goes away and hope it gets ignored. But I'm not going to let it get ignored.
But why are the working class voters moving to him?
I think that we don't appear to be fighting for them. So they get distracted on issues that, first of all, we'll use inflation as an example. Republicans put inflation totally at the feet of higher government spending. That's not what caused inflation. Don't blame it on government spending, for gosh sakes. The answer is that corporations have stock buyback, higher stock buybacks, corporate profits are up, stock market's up, wages have been flat. We need to take on those interest groups that caused that. And, you know, some people, some economists called it transitory. You remember that a few months ago?
I mean, the Biden administration was calling it that.
And that's the mistake we made. I mean, we've seen workers bleed from our party for 30 years. But we've got to bring them back.
Do you think Harris was out of touch on those issues?
She had 100 days to run a campaign. I'm not going to look back and be the critic of that. That's your job.
What about just on the cultural issues itself? I mean, they came after you on transgender issues. You had to cut an ad defending yourself on this issue.
Well, I cut an ad showing they lied.
Yeah.
And people like you, I don't know if you particularly, Manu, but many media fact checkers said it was a lie. But that's what they do. They take an issue that they know polls well, they lie about it, and they put, in this case, they spent $40 million on 8 different ads on that issue.
On transgender issues.
Yeah, they weren't talking about how to make Ohio a better state. They're not doing their job on education. They're not doing their job on health care. They're not doing their job on creating jobs.
But they're winning elections. Are they successful?
They're winning elections in part because they've rigged the system. They made it harder to vote. They've changed ballot language in a draconian, in a dramatic way with the last election. They did that with abortion rights. It didn't work in that case.
Yes, they spent all this money against you guys. One, are you out of touch on those issues? Two, should you guys have done a better job in pushing back?
I'm not out of touch on those issues. I go home, I hear people all the time. I know how they focus group, and they lie. I mean, how do you call me out of touch when they lie about an issue?
I mean, I guess it's been an effective campaign tactic. Do you think it was an effective campaign?
Yeah, so if you want to be so cynical as a reporter that, it worked, we applaud them, so they're so smart.
I'm applauding them. I'm just saying that if it works, it works, right?
Well, yeah, but your job is as someone who is a fair player in this, and I think you are, I've known you a long time, is rather than commenting on it works, comment on they lied, and that's not a fair way to play.
How should your party approach this? Because these attacks.
Party needs to talk to workers. I ran way better than the national ticket, in spite of those attack ads, because many people believe them, no matter what, that's how it happens, because voters trusted me, because they know I fight for them in the workplace.
Trump 2.0. How should Democrats position themselves?
I'm not here. I don't know. But I do think we've got to do it through the prism, as I do in my state, of the dignity of work.
Fan. In an interview with NBC News, Donald Trump reiterated his plans to end birthright citizenship.
You promised to end birthright citizenship on day one. Is that still your plan?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a topic Trump has discussed numerous times, including in this Truth Social post from May 2023 entitled Citizenship Executive Order under his Agenda 47 policy.
That under the correct interpretation of the law, going forward, the future children of illegal aliens will not receive automatic U.S. citizenship.
But can Trump really do that by executive order? Let's verify. Our sources are the U.S. Constitution, Agenda 47, former Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan, Omar Jadwat, director of the ACLU Immigrants Rights Project, and former Solicitor General of the U.S., Neil Katyal. All of our experts say no, it's unconstitutional to end birthright citizenship by executive order, although Trump's argument has never been fleshed out in the courts. Birthright citizenship was established in the 14th Amendment, which was ratified after the Civil War to extend citizenship to former slaves and their descendants. It reads, in part, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States." For more than a century, the U.S. has interpreted that to mean everyone born here except children of foreign diplomats are U.S. citizens, and the only way to change that is by amending the Constitution. Trump disagrees, arguing the phrase "subject to the jurisdiction thereof" means the amendment doesn't apply to children whose parents are in the U.S. illegally, and therefore he can order federal agencies to follow his more rigid approach. He made a similar claim during his first term, but didn't follow through with an executive order. Then-House Speaker Paul Ryan told NPR that he believed ending birthright citizenship would require a constitutional amendment ratified by at least 38 states, and legal experts warn any attempt by Trump to do this on his own would likely end up in court. With your Verify, I'm Brandon Lewis.
There's danger out there. It lurks on highways and quiet neighborhood streets. It's more likely to kill you than a shark, and more terrifying than the biggest snake. Distracted driving claims lives every day. Every notification, swipe, social post, video, or selfie while driving risks your life. So while you might think public speaking or the zombie apocalypse is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward. Don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Crispy, faded, lit, baked, toasty, stoned, blazed, zooted.
When you're high, there are a lot of ways to say it. But there's only one thing you need to remember. Driving under the influence of marijuana is illegal everywhere. If you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Verify viewers wanted to know, can Donald Trump revoke Hunter Biden's pardon once he takes office in January? So let's verify using these sources. The Constitution gives the president sweeping powers to pardon people for federal crimes. There's nothing in the Constitution or federal law that allows anyone to revoke a presidential pardon once it's delivered. There is one gray area, revoking a pardon that hasn't been formally delivered. In 1869, outgoing President Andrew Johnson issued a pardon, which incoming President Ulysses S. Grant tried to revoke. A federal judge ruling on the case wrote, quote, "When a pardon is complete, there is no power to revoke it." But he also said the question remains, when is a pardon complete? He decided it was not complete until the pardon is actually delivered to the person receiving it, or someone with the authority to receive it for them. In this case, the pardon had only made it through a series of messengers, the judge ruled, and was stopped before it could reach the recipient, therefore it could be revoked. This precedent was invoked more recently in 2008 by President George W. Bush. He revoked a pardon he issued after learning new information about the recipient that made him change his mind. The Justice Department at the time argued Bush was allowed to do that because the pardon hadn't been delivered yet. So, under current law, as long as Biden makes sure the pardon has been delivered to his son, it cannot be revoked. With your Verify, I'm Casey Decker.
This morning, we are looking at the impact of industry growth in Central Ohio. Some of the biggest names in the world of data centers are arguing over how much they should pay for electricity. Names like Google, Amazon, Meta, and Microsoft are all requesting massive amounts of utility power from AEP. As 10TV's Kevin Landers reports, there's a lot at stake, not only for the companies, but the people who live in those areas where those data centers want to build.
Amazon, which plans to transform this empty farm field into a data center, along with other data center giants, are pushing back against the plan by AEP to hold them accountable for the energy they use. Meanwhile, those who live across the street from the project are worried about how this will change their quality of life.
Amy Hale doesn't have to look far to see what's coming outside her front door.
Yep.
That empty field to the right of her home will be Amazon's new $2 billion data center.
We were bummed when we first heard the news, honestly. We like the peace and quiet out here.
Delaware County isn't alone in the data center boom. Companies like Google, Meta, Microsoft, and Walmart are adding data centers in central Ohio. Those who live near them want people to know they're not pleased.
I appreciate you getting our side of the story because the first time, you know, people that don't live out in the country aren't really affected too much, I think. So it's nice that you came out here at the farmland to see, like, what's your view on it?
On behalf of Microsoft Corporation.
Today, some of the most powerful law firms in Columbus, representing some of the biggest companies in the world, began to make their case against AEP's plan to require data centers to pay 85% of the energy they plan to use for the next 12 years. They want all energy users to share the cost, not just data centers. AEP's vice president of transmission explained why data centers need to pay more for the huge demand they're asking for.
Central Ohio is where we are seeing significant growth that is driving significant transmission constraints, which if not addressed, they will impact the broader stability and reliability of the entire grid.
AEP says this isn't about a rate increase for homeowners, but to address massive energy demand.
This over here is sold.
As for Amy Hale, the power lines across from her home foretell what's coming. And while she says she has no plans to move, she's preparing for her quiet corner of Delaware County to change forever when the construction of Amazon's data center begins.
What is your biggest worry?
I think just the peace and quiet. I think not being able to enjoy the nature anymore.
The Public Utilities Commission isn't expected to rule on this energy case until sometime next year. The rest of the nation is watching as Ohio becomes the first to set energy rates for these large data centers. In Delaware County, Kevin Landers, 10TV News.
Kevin, thank you. And thank you for joining me for Face the State this week.
Again, that's Angela Ann, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.